Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Elle Halliwell, who's come to talk about her memoir, A Mother's Choice. Welcome, Elle.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
Now, I would like to get a bit of background to this story. So, you're writing for The Telegraph,
yeah.
Fashion, a whole range of things. You're at the sort of pinnacle of your whole... You know, right in the middle of your career,
yep.
Everything's going well. Can you tell us about what your life was like in that period?
It was mental. literally running from events in the morning back to the office to file stories, then doing, you know, our Nova show on Sunday nights, and then I had events on in the nighttime as well. So, look, I had the energy at the time. I was running around. I knew that this was, you know, as you said, the peak of my career, and I had to make it count. So I was burning the candle at both ends,
yeah.
And I knew it, but I kind of thought, look, I'm 30 years old, prime of my life, this is when I need to do that. There's time to rest in, you know, 10, 20 years. So, yes, I was working quite hard and very busy, but loving it too.
Yeah. So what was the sort of thing you were doing? Was like when you talk about going to events, are they all to do with fashion, or were you sort of wandering around different areas?
Entertainment and fashion. So yeah. I'd cover a red carpet event one night, like a movie premiere, something like that. Then the next day I might go to a fashion launch or a fashion showing. Then, you know, writing for a daily paper as well. It's very immediate. So sometimes I'd be sitting in the corner of this glamorous party with, you know, my notebook and my pen in my hand, transcribing things with my earphones in. Like a lot of people, it was almost like a running joke. They go, oh, there's Elle again, you know, with the headphones in the corner, filing a story for the next day's paper. So it was very fast paced. And I did love it, but it was all, every day was a challenge, but yeah. Every day it was different, and I love that.
And it threw you into circles with some of the most glamorous people in Australia at the time?
Yeah, look, I've interviewed some amazing people, got, you know, international celebrities like Ben Stiller, Miranda Kerr, Robert Pattinson, big fan of Robert Pattinson, as you'll probably find out in the book, you know, the One Direction boys. So yeah, there were lots of rubbing shoulders with well-known people. Look, lots of celebrities.
And then one day, tell me about this, because you're not feeling 100%, or what is it that sort of started this new phase?
Well, we're going to become friends quite quickly, because started with about a gastro, actually.
Yes.
Being to dinner with some friends at a French restaurant. And the next day I was actually, and I don't think I put it in the book, I was at a racing event, like the launch of the racing carnival. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be so sick. So I called up my GP, who was my friend, and I said, look, I've got gastro, can I come in? And I was kind of in that zone where I was thinking about maybe starting a family with my husband later that year. So I said to him when I went in and saw him, I was like, can you just do a blood test to check like my folate and my vitamin D levels and stuff? And because I, you know, I wanted my body to be in the right shape before we started trying. And so he checked them out, and then it came back with an abnormal result. I had high platelets. I had no idea what a platelet was. So, and he said, look, it's probably nothing to worry about, because you've had this virus, often it can kind of play havoc with your blood levels. So he said, come back in 2 weeks and we'll, you know, get it tested again. So I went back in 2 weeks, got another test, and the platelets had actually gotten higher rather than going lower. And my doctor was kind of like, look, I don't think it's anything to be too concerned about, but he knew, because we're quite good friends, so he's like, I know you're a bit of a hypochondriac, so what I'll do is I'll refer you to a hematologist so you can rule out anything bad. Yeah. So it took about 5 weeks to get an actual appointment with the hematologist. And in that time, like, there were so many things kind of to organise. Fashion Week was coming up, so I wasn't really too concerned. I was just too busy to really worry about it.
And were then, you feeling okay?
I was feeling tired. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of a standard.
Yeah, because your life was crazy.
Yes, exactly. So I didn't really, I thought that maybe it was the residual effects of the gastro. Mm. And I did tend to get sick every time I took a break from work. And I think it was my body just going, can you just slow down? Like there's too much going on.
Yeah.
And I didn't listen to it. I just continued to ignore my body's signals, I think. And then I went to the hematologist and had the blood test, ran straight back to work. And then the next day, literally, as I got to my desk, I got a phone call from the hematology department saying, you need to come in first thing Monday morning. This was on a Thursday. Come in on Monday morning, and you have to bring we'd like you to bring a loved one with you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point that I literally broke down at my desk, because I knew you don't get asked, you know, to bring a loved one if it's just like a, you know, a residual gastro bug.
Yeah.
That's horrendous. So that was...
That just seems torturous to be told on Thursday. You've got a whole weekend of worry.
That's right.
Completely unknown what's...
You know what? Mean? That is something that... And I've heard this from numerous people, that they've been told the same thing. And I really think that that's something that the medical industry in Australia needs to think about maybe changing. Yeah. Because if you're going to tell somebody to bring a loved one, like, clearly there's something serious going on. And you can't say bring a loved one in 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
Because
no,
that's devastating.
Yeah.
So anyway, I would like to just put that out there to the medical world. Maybe rethink your kind of booking practices when you're about to tell someone they've got cancer.
Yeah, madness. Okay, now you started us off with the story of gastro, and in essence, you have gastro to thank, because if you didn't have it, you probably would have just put this off and off and off and you know, kept going and just assumed that it was because you're living a crazy life.
Yeah, that's right. Steak tartare, thank you so much. Yeah. That was pretty sure that's what it was. Steak tartare or the pâté, because it was a French restaurant. So anyway, I've been back to that restaurant too, and it's amazing food, but yeah.
Well, you know, the universe telling you something.
Yes.
So, hey. You can't get your attention any other way.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I've learnt to listen to my body a lot more now.
So everything kind of grinds to a... at that point.
Yeah.
And you're going on Monday. Well, the weekend's got to be horrendous.
So what happened was, you know, my husband got really upset when, you know, we were told that we'd have to wait 4 days to find out what was wrong with me. So he called our GP and said, mate, what's going on? Like, you can't leave us hanging here. Mm. And he was kind enough to say, look, let me see if I can find out. I'll call the hematologist and see if I can, you know. And it was great, because that night he came around to our house and he sat us down on, you know, our couch in our living room, where we felt safe and, you know, supported. And he broke the news to us. So at least we could kind of prepare for the proper blow on Monday when we found out exactly what that meant. Mm-hmm. You know, all I knew at this stage is that, you know, I had a rare form of leukemia. And in my mind, that was just goodbye, good night. Mm. And then...
Whenever they put rare in front of something.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And
I want the normal one, please.
That's right. Yeah, please give me the common one. Because, you know, all I knew is that a lot of cancers didn't get... you know, the support from the PBS and things like that.
Because there's not enough people and there's not enough money.
Exactly. So all I thought was, A, this is going to cost us a lot of money to try and save my life, or B, there's nothing they can do. That was kind of my feelings at the time. And it was funny because, not funny, but 2 days later, it was on the Saturday, I was still trying to, I guess, come to terms with all of this. And I'd bought a two-pack of... Clear Blue pregnancy tests, because you know, we probably hadn't been too careful, and a couple of weeks beforehand I'd actually taken the test and it had come back negative. So I was pretty sure that I wasn't pregnant, but because I had this spare test, I kind of thought in my mind, let's just rule out the worst case scenario here. And so it was the biggest shock I've actually ever had in my whole life, seeing, you know, that it said you're pregnant on it. And that just opened up a whole new can of worms right there.
Yeah. No, just, I mean, those 3 days, like, just extraordinary. Before we get to the Saturday and the next big shock, we're in the modern era now. Like, we don't have to sit back and go, okay, the doctor told me I have this rare disease. Did you just jump onto Google and start, like, just going crazy and go to Google doctoring yourself? And
well, look, I did do a bit of Google doctoring before, before I found out exactly what was wrong with me. And, you know, there had been kind of mentions of leukemia, because all I saw was, you know, blood abnormalities. Yep. And it was actually funny. I spoke to my dad, like, in between all of these tests, and I was like, yeah, my platelets are high. And he's like, oh, maybe you've got leukemia. I was like, Dad, don't say that. That is ridiculous. I feel fine. And when I was diagnosed, the journalist in me wanted to just find out everything about it. But I also didn't want to know. Because I thought I could literally just be researching my death here. So I kind of just retreated into my shell, and it was actually my husband who became like the big investigative journalist trying to find out more about this illness. And I can't thank him enough for that, because he was the one that kind of tried to, I guess, give me a little bit of hope that, you know, we were going to get through this, whether or not, you know, this pregnancy, you know, happened or didn't, which I thought it was absolutely a certain fact that it wasn't going to. But like I couldn't think about having gone through that without him, because he literally was my rock the whole time.
And the pregnancy coming, when you had both sort of discussed and thought about, we're going to have a try for a child later in the year, to actually have the thing you want after this, like the events coinciding is just, I don't know how your brain coped with it.
It was devastating. It was like the universe was just saying, fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, in what have I done? Terms.
Too much party? Why?
That's right. It was soul crushing.
Mm.
And I guess almost my instant thought was to my baby, though. Like, how cruel could you be to, you know, this new life?
Yeah.
That just doesn't have a chance. Like, there's just no chance that anything's going to come of this. Mm. So that was, a really, really upsetting moment.
So that weekend is horrible. You do go see the specialist.
And what, on the Monday.
And what are the, do you see any road out? Was it all just, this is impossible?
Well, my husband had done some research and found that, like, it was such an unusual situation to be in, like one in a couple of million. But he did find this woman over in the UK who was a CML specialist in this particular leukemia that I had, who had mentioned that there had been a couple of cases where a woman who had been diagnosed in pregnancy, didn't say whether it was at the beginning or right at the end, had carried a baby, through to full term. And so he, I guess, grasped at that tiny little mention as like a bit of a glimmer of hope. And that kind of kept us a little bit, you know, there was like that little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
And he came into this chat with our professor like quite well informed, whereas I was just still kind of sitting there in complete shock still. But I think having had those few days to come to terms with it, so that we could go in to the doctor's office armed with questions, and having, because you could imagine, someone sits you down, says, you've got cancer, then we're going to do this, this is, all you hear is cancer, blah, 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 blah. So I guess being able to kind of go in there, sit down, we recorded the chat so that we could kind of go back and like listen to exactly what he was saying. So we came in prepared, and I think that made such a massive difference to our, I guess, mental well-being.
Now, I don't want to go into all the details of
rambling now.
Talking about it must be difficult. Writing about it, like writing about it is thinking about stuff for hours on end, for weeks and weeks, and sometimes months and months, around something which is the most difficult part of your life. How did they convince you to first do it? And then what was the experience of writing like? Did it help, hinder, make things worse?
It was really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that I was looking forward to before I started it, but I did know, you know, having been a journalist, that, you know, putting things down on paper can be quite cathartic. And I guess it was a way to kind of keep myself busy as well while I was on maternity leave and trying to come to terms with it all. It was like a bit of therapy, and there were a lot of times when, you know, I had to stop, because I wrote a lot at cafes and bookstores and things like that, and I would have to wear my sunglasses and turn my computer screen on really, really high because I, like, tears would pour out, so, and I didn't want someone to see me just, you know, sobbing into my laptop.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of emotion, and I think as well, I interviewed my mum and dad and a few of my other loved ones, because I knew that, you know, this was my perspective, but I also wanted to make sure that everyone else's perspectives were kind of taken into account. And there were also times when I guess I blanked out certain parts of it because it was just too hard.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to kind of talk about it, about certain moments with other people, brought back those memories in much more kind of clear, you know, clarity.
Yeah, but that can also open up more trouble because you didn't realize how affected your family. Like if they start talking about it in honesty for a book, they might say, you know, do you really bring home just how worried they were and all their fears?
Yeah, I think it was good for them as well because... Yeah. They always said to me, you know, how impressed they were, how I held it together, you know, at those really tough points. And I did it because I couldn't bear to see them upset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so being able to talk to them a few months after it all happened, I think was really good for both of us because we could both kind of have a cry because I'd kind of... gotten to that point where I was a bit more accepting of what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it brought me and my parents a lot closer together. And I think that was amazing. Like I wouldn't take that back because for that reason.
And what else do people get in the book? Because you know, the basis of the story you're giving me here, where do you wander? Around.
Well, I mean, I have lived a pretty colourful life, you know, covering red carpets. So there's a little bit of goss in there, a little bit of celebrity behind the scenes goss. There's a few bit of info about some of the hairy moments that I've had, you know, covering celebrities behaving badly, things like that. So there's definitely a lot of light in this book.
Yeah.
And there's also an interesting element with my mum, who was forced to make a similar choice to myself, which played a big part in my decision as well. So I think there's quite a few layers of the book, which means it, you know, there's something in there for everyone.
And what about your work now with the Daffodil?
So I work with the Leukemia Foundation and the Cancer Council. So I was an ambassador for both of them last year and continue to kind of, you know, support them in various ways. Without the Leukemia Foundation, after everything happened, you know, that they were just amazing, offering to, you know, help us with transport to and from appointments and things like that. They helped me track down another woman who'd been in a similar situation so that I could talk to her. Like, they were amazing, and it made me really appreciate, you know, what they do and how their donations help, you know, not only finding a potential cure for cancers like mine, but also just day-to-day support of families that are, you know, going through something like this, and it makes such a huge difference to people's lives. It really does.
Yeah. And you are, where are you now? Like, you've got a beautiful baby, you're back at work, or and you've been writing books. So where are you now?
I am back at work. So working for the telly. You know, doing bits and pieces for Nova 969 as well. But I really found a new passion in health. I'm studying naturopathy at Nature Care College and studying to be a health coach because I was a bit of a guinea pig myself because I not only had to try and figure out what was best for my cancer but also for my baby during that time. And, you know, I did so much research and I kind of thought, how can I kind of share what I've learnt, but also what I'm learning with other people to try and, you know, especially, I really think that more and more women are finding themselves in a situation, to me, you know, whether it's breast cancer or other certain cancers, especially hormone-related cancers, and dealing with a new baby, even if it's not you, it's your spouse or something, but dealing with a new baby and a cancer diagnosis is, like, you know, you can't even explain how difficult that can be emotionally and physically, so... You know, I would love to be able to support women, you know, who are going to have to go through this in the future in any way that they can.
That's marvellous.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming and talking about Mother's Choice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. This is like a dream come true. I've always been such an avid reader. I love books. Like, books have always been a huge part of my life. I do mention that in my book. So to kind of have been invited here to Booktopia to sign books is literally a dream come true. So thank you.
No, thank you for coming in. Thank you for signing a book and thank you for writing a book and sharing your experience.
Anytime. Hopefully not the last time.
And you can get hold of Elle's book, A Mother's Choice, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.